Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is artist and writer Mira Bartok. Bartok is author of 28 books for children, and this year she published an amazing and heartbreaking literary memoir called The Memory Palace. This New York Times bestseller powerfully chronicles the life she and her sister learned to navigate around their brilliant but schizophrenic and often homeless mother. Bartok's writing has also appeared in literary journals and anthologies and has been noted in the Best American Essays series. Currently, she runs Mira's List, a blog that helps artists find funding and residencies all over the world. The Memory Palace has recently been released in trade paperback from Free Press. I'm speaking to Mira Bartok by phone from her home in Western Massachusetts. Mira Bartok, thank you so much for joining us. Now, tell us a little bit about the title of your incredibly beautiful memoir, The Memory Palace. Where did the title come from?
First of all, thank you for calling incredibly beautiful. It's really nice to hear. The title actually comes from an ancient mnemonic device used in the Renaissance, but it's a device of recall that began in ancient Greece, but it was revived in the Renaissance. And it's a system of memorization that I really latched onto because it just was such a great metaphor for my book, since I suffered some memory loss due to a car accident. It's a system where you, for everything you want to remember, any kind of event, idea, person, place, you create an image in your mind, and then you build a palace in your mind and place that image in a room in a palace. And the idea is that if you want to retrieve the memory, you come up with this image, and the image stands for that thing, and it takes you back to that thing you want to remember. And so what I did is I created this palace on my studio wall. And so I used pictures that resonated with me because I'm such a visual thinker, being a visual artist.
Mm-hmm.
And each image that is in the book, each chapter begins with an image, and that takes you back to an event in time.
Mm-hmm.
What we know is memory is not fixed. It doesn't really work as a way of, you know, great memory retrieval nowadays. We just know that the brain works differently than we thought.
Yeah.
But it's a nice metaphor.
It is. It's great for your book, too. And the memory palace begins in the final days of your mother's life. And you hadn't seen her for 17 years. Can you tell us a little bit about her? I know she was mentally ill, homeless. And tell us why you didn't see her for so many years.
My mother was such a beautiful yet tragic person. She had been a musical prodigy. She was a loving, kind person deep inside. But her illness, it so ravaged her, and it became so hard to be with her and not worry about. It just became more and more difficult in a lot of ways. And toward the end of that time when we were together, before that 17-year period, she became more and more violent.
Mm-hmm.
And even though most schizophrenics are not violent, they are more likely to harm themselves, which my mother often tried to do as well, it just became clear that she needed some kind of supervised setting to live in. I didn't want her to be in an institution, but, you know, my sister and I went several times to court to try to get her some kind of legal guardianship in a housing situation, but each time we lost our case in court. The last time we saw her, she attacked me physically, and it was pretty terrifying, and it just became clear that we couldn't have contact with her
mm-hmm.
unless she agreed to have a social worker and get help and take medication and all those things.
She wouldn't do that, right?
She was obviously paranoid,
right?
That's the problem mm-hmm. with a lot of people who are mentally ill is that they don't have, you know, their executive judgment is impaired, so they don't really think they're sick. And for many years, you know, I had lost a couple jobs because of her. I lost relationships. I mean, she would show up at my door. She lived in Cleveland. I lived in Chicago, and she would show up at my door or my job or wherever I was. If I was teaching, I might be teaching a bunch of little children, and she could show up and start screaming and maybe holding a knife. I mean, it just became so difficult to have a life and make a living and have relationships if she was in my life.
Mm-hmm. And yet you and your sister even changed your names to get away from her, correct?
Yes, we did.
Mm-hmm.
But the great thing, I always look on the bright side, is the great thing since my book came out and I've been on the radio and both my names have been out there in the world, I've reconnected with people I lost before this time period when I had changed my name. Because when I changed my name, this was before the internet really took off. And also I've connected with my mother's childhood friends.
Wow.
So people who knew my mother and grew up with her and knew her before she became ill, and some of her friends who knew her after she became ill but wasn't as sick, and they knew, I guess, me as a little baby and knew my father. I've connected with all these people, and so that's been amazing. A lot of these people are still alive, and they had a lot of stories to tell. When I was in Cleveland recently, I stayed with my mother's best friend's younger sister who has the piano my mother played on when she was a little kid.
Wow, that's amazing. And so you really connected with your past, not just through this book, but through finding people from your past. Wow.
Oh, yeah, and people who were in my mother's past. One of my mother's friends, he was a singer, and my mother accompanied him on the piano in high school. We sort of become pen pals. And he's this old guy, you know, living in, I can't even remember where he lives, but...
You know, it's amazing that you and your sister have achieved so much, considering this background, because your father was also a novelist who descended into alcoholism.
Yep.
And so you guys were really pretty much on your own.
Well, the thing is that we had each other, and that was enormous. I mean, I don't know how things would have turned out if we didn't have each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we also had some really great people in the neighborhood. There was a family across the street, the Armstrongs, who were just wonderful and very helpful. And, you know, we had good friends and we had, you know, some good teachers. So I'm sure all those things helped, as well as the gifts my mother gave us. I mean, I know that I got a lot of solace from playing music and drawing and, you know, my sister with writing, and we had big imaginations.
Mm-hmm.
And we had great arts programs in our school system in Cleveland, and free access to the museum, and, you know, all these field trips to hear the symphonies, and libraries that were wonderful. So I'm sure all those things combined helped.
Yeah, I'm sure they did, too. It's really quite an amazing story. I do hope people will read the book. The book is so poetic, Mira. I was just struck by how poetic and beautiful it is. Now, talk to us a little bit about the fact that in 1999 you suffered a traumatic brain injury in a car accident, and how this connects with the book and with your mother.
Yeah, I actually had two accidents. One was at the beginning of 99, I fell on the ice. And about 9 months later, I had another one, and my brain was vulnerable to more damage, even though mostly it was healed. But, you know, we know a lot more about second head injuries now with a lot of research that's been going on. So when you have a second head injury, like kids who go out, you know, and play hockey or football,
mm-hmm.
and they have second concussion, sometimes it can be devastating.
Well, you had to relearn how to read and write and paint and everything, correct?
It wasn't as if I couldn't read at all, and it wasn't as if I couldn't write at all. It had to do with endurance and short-term memory loss and concentration. In the beginning, I could read maybe a paragraph, but strange cognitive things would happen, like I'd get stuck on a word and not understand it, and I couldn't track things visually, and after I read a paragraph, I'd immediately forget it. So I couldn't read anything very long or write anything very long. It might take me 4 hours to write a letter.
Wow.
Or I'd write a letter for 4 hours if you piece together chunks of time, because I had no concentration to do anything for 4 hours.
Hmm.
And then the next day, I would not remember writing it, and I would try to write that over again.
Wow, that is a real, real handicap.
It wasn't a picnic. But, you know, these issues that are brought up in the book, like brain trauma and homelessness and obviously mental illness, mm-hmm. and this difficult childhood, but I like to think that this book is not what I call a real misery memoir.
No, it's not. It's beautiful.
I never mm-hmm. thought of myself as a victim.
Mm-hmm. And that comes out clear in the book that you do not.
Thank you. Because I really don't like those kinds of books. I really wanted this book to be a book that really honored my mother and really showed this connection between us that was artistic and that was full of love despite the distance between us. But also that following my brain injury, I grasped my mother's illness a little better. It's really a book about empathy and compassion.
It is, and connections that continue,
yeah,
no matter how damaged people become. I thought that was interesting that it took you a while to decide whether to tell your mother about the brain injury. And when you did tell her, she said, "They stole my brain, too."
Yeah.
I thought that was really quite amazing.
And in her letters to me, she often wrote how they, whoever they were, the Nazis or the CIA, whoever it was that
the paranoia,
was trying to get
yeah.
her, they were trying to steal her memory. And they would take her out of the city and hook her up to machines and change the rhythm of her heart or steal her memory or implant ideas in her. You know, those are very common paranoid schizophrenic thoughts.
Yeah, yeah, they are. And it's fascinating the way you talk about your mother, even in her madness, was studying things and memorizing names of birds and flowers and studying the stars. And
constantly.
And you sort of inherited that love of knowledge from her.
You know, it's curiosity to the beyond the beyond. Both of us have that, or I have that, and she had that. And she was always like that. And I think, oddly enough, after we separated in 1990, she disappeared, and, you know, I had no idea where she was. She actually left town, and when we reconnected through post office boxes, you know, we wrote each other, it was clear that away from her family and away from her, you know, she was so obsessed about my sister and about me when we were still in physical contact. It opened up this world for her that she could explore that she never got a chance to explore intellectually. I mean, she did before, but it's very clear that after, that's sort of the positive side I try to see of it, you know, in terms of her tragic homelessness, is that she pursued these amazing things and spent her days in libraries and in art museums, you know, and she kept 17 years of diaries, but she also kept 17 years of notebooks on different subjects, which she studied voraciously, mm-hmm. you know.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer and artist Mira Bartok. We're discussing her beautiful memoir called The Memory Palace. Now, let us talk about the fact that you use both words and paintings to recreate some of these moments in your life. Which form is more powerful for you?
Oh, boy. I don't know. I think it really changes. I would say it all informs, one thing informs the other. And I would say probably music above all informs everything.
Mm-hmm. So,
and lately, this summer, I was on book tour for the hardcover up through June, and, mm-hmm. and then I had the summer off, and then, boom, my paperback came out in August. So I had very little time this summer, and I spent most of it playing music.
Mm.
And also drawing. I had to take a rest from that other part of my brain. But when I write, I walk while I write the first draft of something. I talk into a voice recorder. So I have to hear myself. It has to sound like music. And then when I'm writing, when I'm putting things down into the computer, sometimes I pull up images that I have in my computer to sort of get me going,
mm-hmm.
or I stop and I draw, and then sometimes I need to take a break and not use any words at all and maybe take 2 months and just draw. So it goes back and forth, and sometimes they're all battling for attention.
Is that when you take
annoying.
A nap?
And I have no, and my focus is like right now. I'm on book tour. I have no time to do anything, but I'm dying to do something creatively, and I don't know where to go. I don't know what to do first.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I guess they all are, you know, making art, playing music, and writing. They're all friends, but sometimes they're enemies. So
yeah, well, you can just leave them in the room and let them fight it out while you take a nap or something like that.
That's kind of what I did yesterday.
I want to bring this up. You came up with a really good vital question in this book, and that you and your sister have probably talked about. Would your mother have been better off medicated and in a hospital? Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because she did still have a lot of creativity coming out of her.
You know, I would say that my sister would probably say, yes, she would have been better off that way, or at least this, you know, years ago my sister would have said that. And I would have said, well, not in a hospital, but I don't think my sister wanted her in a hospital. I think both of us wanted her safe and fed and in a situation that was more like a community, maybe like a halfway house.
Mm-hmm.
And there used to be a recovery center for the mentally ill population when, you know, near our house before Reagan came to power, and then all funding was lost.
Mm-hmm.
And so my mother did a little better during that time because she could take life skills classes. There were support groups and all that sort of thing. I guess the best of all possible worlds would have been that my mother had some kind of community living situation where she was supervised and had medication that actually worked for her, mm-hmm. and that she also could be creative in some way. But, you know, I don't know. After I did my final draft of this book, I really thought hard about, and I still am questioning whether or not she was happier in the long run being her most creative self during those 17 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think that she felt the last 3 years of her life, as tragic as it was that she lived in a shelter, she was so loved by these women and so watched over.
Mm-hmm.
And she had also slowed down so much in her, you know, she was very delusional, but she also had slowed down in her, you know, her rantings and all that stuff. But her creative output was just as strong. So in a way, you know, oddly enough, the last 3 years of her life were maybe some of the happiest, because she was in a community at the women's shelter in Cleveland, now renamed in her honor. I don't know if you know that.
Oh no, I don't remember hearing that. Oh,
it's
terrific.
Called the Norma Hare Women's Center, I think it'll be a year anniversary next month for. Hmm. The renaming and the rebuilding of the shelter.
Wow, that's what a great honor for her. Her,
yeah.
You know, I have to tell the listeners that Mira puts excerpts from her mother's diary in front of each chapter, and some of the excerpts are just amazing.
Yeah, sometimes I think she was the real writer in the family.
One of the things she wrote, I have learned to discipline myself and reserve my pain and sorrow only for sleep. I thought that was so beautiful. You know,
she had some beautiful lines. I mean, I actually took some, before I even wrote this book, I took some excerpts from her letters and put together a monologue that I did, this theatrical piece, years ago, because her writing, just in her letters to me, was so stunning.
Oh, yeah. I'm so glad you shared that with us. It's such a beautiful portrait of your whole family, really. Now I want to ask you this. Do you and your sister worry that you could inherit her illness?
We're really too old.
well, for that particular illness, it usually starts as a young adult.
Yeah, for that particular illness, I mean, and, you know, I think my sister might have worried about it when she was younger, and I, for some reason, never worried about it, call it naivete or, you know, schizophrenia usually strikes late teens and early 20s,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Statistically. And I don't know why, but I've always had a really strong emotional just a stable foundation inside me. I just didn't inherit any kind of extreme, any kind of mental illness, even depression. I mean, I've had situational depression, like if someone close to me dies,
mm-hmm.
Or, you know, if I broke up with a boyfriend or something like that.
Oh, sure, that's normal, yeah.
But I'm too curious and too, I don't have the depression gene.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the chemical imbalance or whatever causes that. I just don't have it, and I'm really grateful for that. And, you know, both my sister and I are really, really driven to create and mm-hmm. to be in the world. And we have really good friends, and you know, we've sort of created really good communities. So,
in other words, you're not worried about that at this point. Did you and your sister discuss some of your memories that you put into this book to trade notes and see if you were remembering the same thing she was, and how did you deal with a living person like her being portrayed in your book?
That's a great question. She wanted to do that. She thought that would be a good idea.
To compare notes?
Yeah, and I said, not at all, not interested. And the reason is that I was very interested in memory itself, and I was very interested in how we misremember and what that means. And I was reading a lot of neuroscience, and I was reading a lot about memory research. And so because of that, I was much more interested in telling my own story, and I was worried that if I got any influence from anyone, especially my sister, it would make me not only doubt the memories I wanted to portray, but doubt myself as a writer and doubt my own experience. This had to be my story.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and naturally, my sister, I would imagine she was rather nervous about being portrayed in a way, and she didn't, you know, who knows how I would portray her. I mean, even if I told her, oh, you come out real, you'll love how you're portrayed, why should she believe me? You know, because sometimes you think you're writing about someone a certain way, and they might not like the way they're portrayed anyway. But fortunately, after she read the book, she loved it, and she felt I really got her, and it's made our relationship even better. I mean, mm-hmm. we have had conversations that we haven't had for over 20 years. So it's been really wonderful for our relationship. And also, you know, aside from all these friends of my mom's that have contacted me, some of our childhood friends have connected with both of us. And that's been wonderful for my sister as well. We started this thing where every summer we all rent. These are little girls who are all in the same block. So a couple of them I've known since I was four. And we got together this summer, and my sister was part of that. And it just was such an emotionally powerful thing and wonderful for her and for both of us. And so every summer we all will get together from now on and rent a cottage somewhere. And all of us seven or eight little girls, now we're, you know, more geezerly, but we are all together. And I think that's another great thing about what's happened with this book and my sister really appreciating it and giving it the green light. You know, I gave it to her to read before it was published, but when I felt it was really done.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it all worked out fine, thank goodness.
That's great. That's wonderful. That's great to hear. I was wondering about that. I want to quote something that you said. You said, "We children of schizophrenics are great secret keepers, the ones who don't want you to think anything is wrong." So was it hard for you to write this book with that in mind? Was it a way to kind of allow the ghosts to rest in peace?
You know, I started writing this book more with the intention of sharing with people the gifts that my mother had given me. And it evolved into, yes, that's definitely there in the book, but it evolved into this other kind of book. And I never intended to tell a lot of, it was hard to write this book. Less about telling the world about it, because I didn't do it for therapy. I did it really to transform it into literature.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't set out to. I have this story to tell, and I'm going to do it for cathartic reasons. It'll make me feel better. It's just not my thing. I don't do that. But I think it was just hard to write about certain things, certain events, like, you know, the last time I saw my mother. You know, my first version of that chapter is, you know, pretty detached. mm-hmm. and with not many details. And in the first version of this book, I had nothing in there about my brain injury at all.
Oh, really?
I just didn't want to bother people with it. It just seemed like, oh, you don't stop whining about it.
it's a huge part of your story, though. Your book
your book is so much about memory, and you had a brain injury. I mean, come on.
I would have said that to you, too, Mira. It's so much a part of the book.
Yeah, I might have said it in passing in one sentence. And then so, I mean, that's the nature of memoir. You know, sometimes you don't really know what your book is about until you're, you know, halfway there, or some really smart person says, you know, duh. Like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah. Well, what do you want people to take from this book? We only have about a minute and a half left. So tell us what you want people to take from this book.
I want them to take whatever they want to take. I think, but I guess in my heart of hearts, I would say the essence of this book is about compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's all in that first sentence of my prologue when I say, you know, a homeless woman, let's call her my mother for now or yours, sits on a window ledge in late afternoon in a working class neighborhood, and I go on and on and on. And I want people to say, that woman on the street, she could be my, she could be your mother, but she also could be mine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'm
sure she's someone's sister. She's someone's friend. Mm-hmm. And so that's at the heart of it. You know, I think it's the heart of this book is about love, and it's about compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's a really beautiful book, Mira. It's absolutely gorgeous, and there's no way we could talk about it and give it justice, because you must read this book. It's filled with poetry and compassion and love, and, you know, just the thought of memory is so important now, I think.
Thank you.
So tell us what you're working on now real quickly, and any new books on the horizon?
I'm working on 5 million things when I have 2 seconds to work on them. I'm writing some very, very short prose poems that I have no idea what I'll do with them. And I have a young adult illustrated novel that's set in the Arctic that I really am biting at the, you know, I'm just trying to get the time to do work on that, because that's my big project next. And I'm playing a lot of fiddle.
Oh, that's great. Well, can you give some contact information real quick?
Yeah, people can, people should go to my website, which is thememorypalace.com. They can go to my hub, which is mirabartok.com, which will link people to my arts blog and children's books and all kinds of things. And if anyone wants to contact me, they can just write me at mira@mirabartok.com. But go to that website to make sure.
Yeah, that's great.
I can't remember what it is.
Well, we're gonna have to leave on that note. Mira Bartok, thank you so much for joining us. And again, the book is called The Memory Palace. Go out and get it. Thank you so much, Mira.
Thank you, Tish. It was wonderful talking to you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.